From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Mumia. The panther beret, the thinking dreadlocks, dissident words that swarm the microphone like a hive.
Today, the poem NPR dared not air.
Calling out their names even after the police bombardment that charred their black bodies.
American Book Award winner Martina Spada describes his encounter with censorship. Then Allen Ginsberg, 2 weeks before he died, reading the words of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
By the 70s, people began to admit that the media was in the hip pocket of big business. Well, today, the media is big business. The major media organizations are not just controlled by it, they are part of it. Many of them are owned by huge multinational corporations. And if you think they don't control what comes over the air, you're in for a surprise. If I control your paycheck, I tell you what to say and what not to say.
And we go to Indonesia for a report on today's sham elections. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Central Intelligence Agency, which has repeatedly pledged for more than 5 years to make public the files from its secret mission to overthrow the government of Iran in 1953, has said it has destroyed or lost almost all the documents decades ago. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has said there is no prospect of a summit with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to break a two-month-old peace deadlock sparked by Israeli settlement in the occupied land. The impasse deepened yesterday as the Treasury said Israel plans to pump some $16.5 million into further development of Jewish settlements. This news from Kinshasa, Congo. Soldiers broke up a banned opposition march on the eve of Laurent Kabila's inauguration as president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, his new name for Zaire. Several thousand supporters of veteran opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi took part in the march, denouncing the presence of Rwandans among Kabila's forces who marched into Kinshasa on May 17th to oust the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko. Soldiers from Kabila's alliance allowed the march to go ahead after initial hesitation, but dispersed the protesters later. And 5 weeks after testimony began in the trial of Timothy McVeigh, his lawyers have unleashed their final salvo against the prosecution's most powerful witness, then rested their case. The chief target on the final day of evidence was the credibility of Michael Fortier, McVeigh's old army buddy, who testified for the government 2 weeks ago that McVeigh had told him of plans to build a truck bomb and that both of them cased the federal building in Oklahoma City a few months before just such a bomb demolished it. And finally, Bob Dylan is being treated for a potentially fatal chest infection that forced him to cancel an upcoming European tour. Dylan turned 56 on Saturday. He was admitted to an undisclosed hospital over the weekend with severe chest pains. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to turn our attention to disturbing allegations of censorship, one of the country's most critically acclaimed poets, by National Public Radio. Martina Spada, called the Latino poet of his generation, has published poetry in the New York Times Book Review, Harper's, The Nation, and Plowshares. His fifth book of poetry, Imagine the Angels of Bread, won the American Book Award and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. A few weeks ago, you could have heard a poem that he did that was asked for by National Public Radio, but why don't we let Martina Spada tell the story, because in the end you couldn't hear it. They decided not to air it. Martina Spada joins us. He's a professor now at the University of Massachusetts. He joins us from an Amherst radio station. Why don't you tell us what happened over these past few weeks?
Okay. First of all, it might help to understand that I have had an ongoing relationship with National Public Radio, in particular All Things Considered. In the past, All Things Considered would regularly broadcast my poems in conjunction with news stories, and one producer even commissioned a New Year's poem from me. In fact, that was Imagine the Angels of Bread, which later became the title poem of the book you referred to that just won the American Book Award. In any event, as a result of that relationship, I got a call this past April, early in the month, from the staff at All Things Considered, and I was commissioned to write a poem as before with the New Year's poem. This time I was commissioned to write a poem for National Poetry Month. And the general idea was that the poem should be like a news story with a journalistic perspective, as if I were a correspondent. And in fact, I do have radio experience with Back Porch Radio, WORT, in Madison. Well, in particular, they suggested I could write a poem in response to a news story in a city I visited during the month. And that made sense because, being National Poetry Month, I was traveling everywhere. At one point, in fact, someone from All Things Considered called to obtain my travel itinerary so that perhaps they could think of an assignment relevant to a particular city. Now, they couldn't think of any such assignment, but the idea had already found a home in my brain and the wheels had started to turn. And so I was thinking about writing a poem when I visited Philadelphia. And in fact, I believe I had even mentioned to them that I would be visiting Philadelphia, but there was no connection made at the time. In any case, I read in the Philadelphia Weekly of April 16th that there were new developments in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. In fact, I'm sure that most of your listeners know who Mumia is, the African-American journalist and activist convicted in the 1981 slaying of police officer Daniel Faulkner in Philadelphia under extremely dubious circumstances. And of course, he's now on death row awaiting execution. What I read in the Philadelphia Weekly about Mumia was the following, that essentially Cynthia White, who had been the star witness for the prosecution at his original trial, had testified on Mumia's behalf at his last hearing and then subsequently disappeared. And this is an important story. Now, what happened next was that Leonard Weinglass, the attorney for Mumia, decided to go out and find yet another witness, another prostitute who could testify on behalf of Mumia at his next hearing, who was present that evening. In any case, this was the basis or the nucleus of the poem. Well, I also visited the tomb of Walt Whitman in nearby Camden, right across the bridge, and so Walt Whitman found his way into the poem, particularly Whitman's tomb, which became a place of refuge for what I call the fugitive slave for Cynthia White and then Mumia, should the worst come to pass. This was based directly on a verse of Whitman's from Song of Myself, where he gives refuge to a fugitive slave. Well, I faxed the poem to All Things Considered on April the 21st. On April the 24th, I still hadn't received a response, so I called from Chicago, where I was traveling, and I was told by the staff at All Things Considered that they would not air the poem. And they were quite explicit. They would not air the poem because of its subject matter, Mumia, and its political sympathies. And I wanted to be clear, I wanted to be sure, so I made a statement. I said, NPR is refusing to air this poem because of its political content. Do you agree? And the reply I received was, yes, one-word reply. I was reminded of the history of NPR and Mumia, which, of course, is a reference to their refusal to air his radio commentaries after first agreeing to do so, and that is now, as we know, the subject of a First Amendment lawsuit filed by Mumia Abu-Jamal. But there were a few other reasons offered. It was explained to me that this was not the way NPR wants to return to this subject, and that's a quote. I was stumped. I talked for about 20 minutes to two different people, a producer and assistant producer. And then I pondered what to do with the poem. Well, that same weekend, I met Marilyn Jamal, who's Mumia's former wife, the mother of his children, and I gave her the poem. And I watched her read it, and I watched her struggle against tears. And then she said, I promised myself that I wouldn't cry anymore. Suddenly, this had a human dimension for me that it had lacked previously, and I concluded that I had to tell a story about the censorship of the poem at All Things Considered. So in subsequent weeks, what happened was that certain journalists contacted All Things Considered, and they got a somewhat different story from what I had heard on the telephone and on April 24th. There was now a public position on the situation. The public position was this, as expressed by their executive producer, Ellen Weiss, that the problem with this poem was the legal status The problem with the poem was that Mumia Abu-Jamal had a lawsuit against NPR, and that lawsuit was pending. And that as long as the lawsuit was pending, NPR would not air any commentaries or op-ed pieces about Mumia Abu-Jamal. This was policy. This was a legal justification for the act of censorship that I had encountered. Now, strangely, the two people who made the decision not to air the poem and informed me of that decision never mentioned such a policy in a telephone conversation of 20 minutes. And yet, some weeks later, this was the official position. As one producer told Dennis Bernstein of KPFA, quote, it's a legal thing. And the poem had now become defined as a commentary and not a work of art, because that definition would justify censorship under their policy of not airing any commentaries as long as his lawsuit was pending. Now, I should point out that I am not only a poet, but I'm also a lawyer. And this legal justification to me was quite amusing, because it's no justification at all. In fact, we've all heard about the principle of not speaking on matters which are being litigated. We all know something about that, even if it's only from television, that you're not supposed to talk about something that's being litigated. But the reason for silence in the face of pending litigation doesn't apply here. The reason that corporations like NPR say no comment is because they don't want the statements to be used against them in court. Now, as a poet or independent person, I'm not a corporate spokesman. I can't bind the corporation. Nothing I say can be used against them in court. And the rationale doesn't apply to a poet reading a poem. It makes no sense at all. And furthermore, the subject of the lawsuit and the subject of the poem are totally different. The censored poem is not about Mumia's commentaries or his First Amendment rights. And Mumia's lawsuit does not concern his criminal case or his possible execution. That's what the poem is about. And a friend of mine, an attorney named Bill Newman, raised a rather ominous question. He asked, if Mumia were to dismiss his lawsuit, would they air this poem? Because that's where this goes, logically, if you follow their logic. So ultimately, if this indeed is NPR's policy, and remember, this is not what was told to me at all when I was told the poem would not be aired. If this is NPR's policy, even ex post facto, it's punitive. It's a means of perpetuating Mumia's silence by silencing those who would speak for him. And a number of people have asked me this question. They said, well, look, you know, you knew their history with Mumia Abu-Jamal. You knew about the censored commentaries. You knew about the First Amendment lawsuit. You knew that this was bound to be sensitive. Why did you write this poem? And I think that's a good question. It requires an answer. And my answer is simply this. First of all, how could I not write this poem once it came to me? How could I censor my imagination and make myself complicit in this enforced silence of Mumia Abu-Jamal? Ultimately, however, on a practical basis, I thought better of the people at All Things Considered. I gave them the proverbial benefit of the doubt. And I even speculated, given NPR's refusal to air Mumia's commentaries, that a sense of fairness or a respect for opposing viewpoints would compel All Things Considered to air the poem. And airing the poem, in fact, would also address the concerns of those listeners who felt that NPR did not do the right thing for Mumia the first time around. And I guess I was wrong about that. So that's the best way I could summarize this. Now, there are more details, which I'm sure will come out in the course of our conversation, but that's basically what happened.
Well, perhaps the best way to go right now would be to actually hear that poem that National Public Radio would not allow its listeners to hear. You're listening to Martina Spada, who has written many books of poetry, his latest, Imagine the Angels of Bread, the poem.
This poem is called Another Nameless Prostitute Says the Man is Innocent for Mumia Abu-Jamal, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Camden, New Jersey, April 1997. The board-blinded windows knew what happened. The pavement sleepers of Philadelphia, groaning in their ghost-infested sleep, knew what happened. Every black man blessed with the gashed eyebrow of nightsticks knew what happened. Even Walt Whitman knew what happened, poet a century dead, keeping vigil from the tomb on the other side of the bridge. More than 15 years ago, the cataract stare of the cruiser's headlights, the impossible angle of the bullet, the tributaries and lakes of blood, Officer Faulkner dead, suspect Mumia shot in the chest, the nameless witnesses who saw a gunman running away, his heart and feet thudding. The nameless prostitutes know, hunched the curb, their bare legs chilled. Their faces squinted to see that night, rouged with fading bruises. Now another nameless prostitute has disappeared, says the newspaper. Perhaps she stiffens, eyes open in a fresh bed of soil, or floats in the warm Gulf Stream of her addiction, or hides from the fanged whispers of the police in the tomb of Walt Whitman, where the granite door is open and fugitive slaves may rest. Mumia, the panther beret, the thinking dreadlocks, dissident words that swarm the microphone like a hive, sharing meals with people named Africa, calling out their names even after the police bombardment that charred their black bodies. So the governor has signed the death warrant. The executioner's needle would flush the poison down into Mumia's writing hands with the fingers curl like a burned spider. His calm, questioning mouth would grow numb, and everywhere radios sputter to silence in his memory. Beyond the courthouse, a multitude of witnesses chants, prays, shouts for his prison to collapse, a shack in a hurricane. Mumia. If the last nameless prostitute becomes an unraveling turban of steam, if the judge's robes become clouds of ink swirling like octopus deception, if the shroud becomes your Amish quilt, if your dreadlocks are snipped during autopsy, then drift above the ruined RCA factory that once birthed radios to the tomb of Walt Whitman, where the granite door is open and fugitive slaves may rest.
Martina Spada, reading the poem that National Public Radio dared not air. We'll be back with him in just 60 seconds, but before actually we do that, it'll be a bit more than 60 seconds, because we want to turn to Mumia Abu-Jamal himself and the commentary that the Prison Radio Project recorded just months ago, after which the Pennsylvania authorities cracked down and said no prisoner could be video, audio taped, or photographed. But we did get these audio commentaries, and this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest-growing public housing tract in America. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. American mass media is a marvel of technology. It is whiz-bang, sparkle glitter, and satellite wizardry. It is a master plan of methods to communicate in a pauper's worth of substance. With such technology, how are people so woefully misinformed? The average American neither knows nor cares about the vast world beyond the nation's border. The average American student knows little math, no history, and very little geography, and nor does he or she want to know. Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly. On November 2nd, 1995, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly, 117-3, to condemn the United States for its continuing blockade of Cuba. The international community called the United States blockade a flagrant act of aggression and a blatant violation of international law. That the UN vote was reported at all in American media is amazing. For such news is more often than not passed over entirely by the American press. But where was information about the blockade itself, the effects suffered by the Cuban people, in-depth comments from United Nations delegates and leaders around the world. For a more substantive report, one had to listen to the BBC World News Service, for the rest of the world takes note of events the US prefers to ignore. American media is a business, and it has a mission, not to inform Americans, but to entertain them. Every media enterprise in America reports the drivel that Marsha Clark and Chris Darden are secret lovebirds, but the vote of a global assembly condemning US actions received only scant coverage at best. Why? The media is a source of titillation more than information. The mission of the media is to please, to comfort, and primarily to sell. When TV was developed, it was promised that every American would learn about the world in his living room. When computers were developed, wasn't it said that they would be invaluable learning tools and that children would learn more faster? National scholastic tests show otherwise, as kids master computers as toys and learn splendid hand-to-eye coordination, but little else. The media paints false pictures of the nation and the world, pictures designed to serve corporate masters and to make America look good. This feel-good media approach serves the American delusion of white supremacy, but it does not inform. When the New York Times echoes the National Star, what can the word media mean? How could millions be surprised at Minister Farrakhan's enormous influence among blacks unless the media wasn't doing its job? How could they look at a million and count less than half that number? The major media, like its racist projections, is to be rejected, not consumed, for your very patronage gives it life. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Mumia Abu-Jamal on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Before we return to our interview with poet Martina Spada, we wanted to share some words from another poet, Allen Ginsberg. Before Allen Ginsberg died last month, he had a chance to record his thoughts about Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as one of Abu-Jamal's commentaries.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, husband, father, grandfather, African-American, lives a prisoner in the biggest growth industry in America. For 15 years, he has been a resident of Pennsylvania's Death Row. Tune in to hear his rare, courageous voice. Mumia Abu-Jamal's raw and impassioned commentaries are certain to fuel the controversy surrounding freedom of speech and the death penalty. Listen to an incisive, experienced critic of our criminal justice system, speaking from the depths of prison. Listen to Mumia Abu-Jamal. The promise of death is not enough. The state of Pennsylvania wants to shut out Mumia Abu-Jamal's voice and enforce his silence. For 15 years, Mumia has been fighting not only to stay alive, he's been waging a battle for the freedom to write and to speak. Through a torrent of lockdowns, investigations, and mental torture, Mumia Abu-Jamal's voice continues to be heard. Whether Mumia Abu-Jamal's voice will reach the airwaves and his message to people, and ultimately whether he lives or dies, will depend on our independence, the depth of his supporters' courage, and your will to organize. I'll read selections from an essay, Objectivity and the Media, that the state of Pennsylvania has forbidden Mumia Abu-Jamal to read to you. Mumia wrote not long ago, quote, "By the 70s, people began to admit that the media was in the hip pocket of big business. Well, today, the media is big business. The major media organizations are not just controlled by it, they are part of it. Many of them are owned by huge multinational corporations. And if you think they don't control what comes over the air, you're in for a surprise. If I control your paycheck, I tell you what to say and what not to say." I remember being down in Pennsylvania at my petition hearing in the fall of 1995. I was being shuttled back to the prison, and the sheriff had turned the radio on. The newscasters were announcing that ABC had just been acquired by the Disney Corporation. I laughed. I was in the back of the van laughing and laughing and thinking to myself that it won't be long before they have Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck on the evening news. On a deeper level, of course, it is no laughing matter when the power of the press is exercised in concert with the political machinery that is in place today. I am talking about the right-wing shift in American politics. What you have is a dangerous, malevolent concoction. It might sound paranoid, but it is what you have. Has our government, our press, acted on the right side of history? Have they stood on the right side of fundamental justice? The level of political discourse in our country is anti-life, and the press is not innocent.
That was the late Allen Ginsberg reading from a piece by death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Allen Ginsberg has not been the only poet to support Mumia Abu-Jamal. In our previous segment, we were talking with University of Massachusetts professor and poet Martina Spada. Like Mumia Abu-Jamal before him, Martina Spada had been describing how his own words were banned from the airwaves of national public radio. Producers at All Things Considered asked him in April to write a poem on a newsworthy topic, a kind of news story in the form of a poem. He chose, fatefully, to write about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. But NPR, which canceled a series of commentaries from Mumia Abu-Jamal only 3 years ago, refused to air Espada's poem, called "Another Nameless Prostitute Says the Man is Innocent." Kathy Scott, the director of communications for NPR, told reporters it was not prudent journalism to air a poem by Mumia. Martina Spada, here you are, a man who's won the American Book Award. You've gotten a great deal of attention and acclaim. You were asked by NPR to do the poem, and though not on specifically this topic. Were you surprised by the censorship?
Well, I leave that kind of conclusion to my readers and my listeners. I felt that the poem was complex, that the poem is not simply a polemic or a propagandistic piece. It's not what I think of as a commentary. If it were, then I would not bother with images, metaphors, similes, assonance, alliteration, oxymoron, line breaks, stanza breaks, and all the other poetic devices at work here. It's a work of art. At least it's an attempt at a work of art. And I think censoring art is dangerous business. And certainly, once we begin to censor art, where do we stop? And furthermore, what makes the decision by the people at All Things Considered to censor this work of art any different from those who would censor Robert Mapplethorpe or other controversial artists in recent history? It's a very, very dangerous thing, I think.
So where do you go from here? Would you consider suing National Public Radio? But of course, if you do, then they wouldn't allow you to share your poems on the airwaves because they'd say you're in litigation.
Well, I, first of all, being a lawyer, I'm well aware of the time, money, energy, and grief involved in litigation. And this is not how I think about the poem or the controversy. In fact, I'd be interested to see how Mumia's litigation turns out, because if his First Amendment rights are vindicated, then perhaps I would have a legal claim. But even then, I'm not sure that I would pursue it. To me, that's not quite the issue. I understand certainly why Mumia has filed his lawsuit, and he, to me, clearly has a breach of contract claim. The First Amendment claim he's making is very interesting because it involves defining National Public Radio as essentially a quasi-governmental agency, since it receives government funding and is subjected to the pressure of government officials such as Senator Bob Dole, who was vociferous when NPR intended to air Mumia's commentaries, and Dole's pressure was instrumental in those commentaries being canceled. Now, if it is determined by the court that NPR is a quasi-governmental agency, then there would be some state action here in terms of censorship, and NPR would be subjected to the strictures of the First Amendment. That remains to be seen. I think this is certainly an open question. But someone, as another attorney with the ACLU here, pointed out to me, well, if he has a claim and it turns out to be valid, maybe you do too. But I want to reiterate, I think that that's not how I'm approaching this. I'm approaching this from the perspective of a poet who has a poem in here that's been censored. And, you know, I can't express, in fact, words cannot articulate for me how that feels. To have been censored so openly. You know, I'm not naive. I am fully aware of the fact that editorial decisions are made on a political basis every day, but rarely is the curtain lifted so that we can actually see the machinery at work. And so it feels very strange. It also feels strange because I would expect that this could happen with ABC, NBC, mainstream corporate media. But when so-called alternative media censors, or what we think of as alternative media censors, then the impact is devastating, I think. And not simply in terms of my own situation, but in terms of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is the person, I hasten to point out, who has the most to lose in this situation.
You know, it's interesting that NPR uses the excuse of it's in litigation, this time with Mumia Abu-Jamal, because when Pacifica decided to air the latest commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, this a few years after a National Public Radio commissioned the commentaries, but at the last second, pulled them when they got tremendous pressure from the Fraternal Order of Police. When Pacifica said that they would air them and also actually asked for the commentaries that they have locked away in a safe, since they didn't want to air them, we say, why not let Pacifica air them? They also gave the reason of it's in litigation, but I think that was more about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case in court being in litigation, his own case, you know, being on death row. And of course, it seems that the only way that Mumia Abu-Jamal's case will not be in litigation is if he's executed. That's the only time the litigation will end.
Well, certainly, there is an ominous portent here. It has been put to the staff of All Things Considered that perhaps that's what they're waiting for. And I believe it was Dennis Bernstein of KPFA who asked them, would you air this poem as Mumia's obituary? And he did not receive an answer. But, you know, consider what this policy implies. They censor Mumia by refusing to air the commentaries. Then he exercises his First Amendment right to try and remedy that violation by going to court. And then NPR compounds that violation of his freedom of expression by refusing to allow others to comment on his behalf. Consider the chilling effect on the exercise of First Amendment rights. It's striking. It's very striking and sad. And I want to point out here that I think this is not only sad for Mumia Abu-Jamal or for a poet who can't get his poem on the on All Things Considered. It's sad for NPR. It's sad because I think that NPR could be so much more, and I believe in this particular situation, the people there have lost all sense of perspective or proportion, and when fear motivates the coverage of the news, then we censor ourselves, and that's the most troubling censorship of all.
You know, it's interesting that they also say that this is not how they wanted to revisit Mumia Abu-Jamal's case with your poem, because that suggests that they haven't covered it since they basically impounded his commentaries and put them in a safe. But there have been a number of developments in the case since then, so this is not the way they're revisiting the case. Presumably, they've been covering his case as he went to court, as the witnesses came forward, or perhaps they're not.
Well, I am aware of a couple of instances where they, where NPR has aired news reports, what they would think of as hard news, concerning Mumia Abu-Jamal since the controversy over his censored commentaries. Everyone who's heard those reports, I have not, pointed out to me that they were extremely negative in character. They were, in effect, harsh criticisms of Mumia's position, albeit characterized as hard news. What was different about my poem is that it's a poem very sympathetic to Mumia, where the politics are very clear in that regard. And I wonder, one of the things that occurred to me is if this poem had been a poem questioning his position or a poem which took no position on his situation, would they have aired it? Very possibly. You know, if it's a poem which would have cast doubt on his claims of innocence, would they have put it on the air? Perhaps they would. It seems as if that may have been a factor in deciding not to air this poem.
Martina Spada, I'm sure you've heard about what happened with Democracy Now! When we tried to air the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We did air them, but all the public radio stations owned by Temple University, a dozen of them in Pennsylvania, dropped us because Temple said it was inappropriate to air Mumia Abu-Jamal's voice. But they cited NPR as precedent, saying if it's inappropriate for NPR, it's inappropriate for us. So the ramifications of this kind of censorship go beyond NPR. It sets an example for stations around the country, for media around the country, not to mention a message to journalists and artists that this is not the kind of thing you cover if you want the imprimatur or the avenue of NPR.
Absolutely. Censorship is cancerous. The cancerous cells of censorship multiply far beyond anything we would expect, and they eat away at the body we call the media.
Martina Spada, we want to thank you very much for joining us, professor of English at the University of Massachusetts. He's been called the Latino poet of his generation. His fifth book of poetry, Imagine the Angels of Bread, won the American Book Award. It was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today, Indonesia, the fourth most populous country in the world, stages nationwide elections for parliament. But the term elections is hardly the word that one would use to describe what's happening in the Asian country. All the so-called opposition parties are creations of the government, and the ruling Golkar Party, headed by the dictator Suharto, has already announced that it expects to win 70.02% of the vote. Still, Suharto faces strong opposition from democratic groups who are boycotting the election. But as we reported here on Democracy Now! Earlier this month, the government has launched a fierce crackdown on pro-democracy activists, including outlawing and imprisoning leaders of one of the leading groups, the People's Democratic Party. Joining us from Indonesia to update us on the situation is Medea Benjamin. She's director of the San Francisco-based human rights group Global Exchange, which is leading an unofficial delegation to monitor the electoral process. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Medea. First of all, where are you in Indonesia?
I'm in East Java. I'm in a town called Malang, which has been traditionally a base of support for the most popular leader right now in Indonesia, Megawati, who has not been allowed to run in the elections.
I'm looking at Reuters, and it says Indonesians are voting today in parliamentary elections officially described as a festival of democracy, but marred by the worst political violence in 30 years in the world's fourth most populous nation. On the eve of the poll, which analysts say his ruling Golkar Party is assured of winning comfortably, Suharto urged his countrymen to exercise their democratic rights with a large turnout. Can you talk about this festival of democracy?
Well, it ain't much of a festival, that's what I can say. It's rigged on whatever level you want to look at it. There's only three parties that are allowed to participate, and one of those parties has had its leader, Megawati, ousted. The elections are so tightly controlled that every single candidate running on the party ticket has had to been approved by the military, and every speech that they've given in public has had to been approved by the government as well. No other parties are allowed to participate. You're not allowed to criticize the government, even if you are a legal recognized party. Most of the country's most outspoken critics are in jail. That includes the young student group called the PRD, as well as labor leaders, anybody trying to organize independent labor unions, as well as somebody who formed his own party and said that there should be a boycott of these elections because it's not free and fair, and he is behind bars as well. Anybody who has called for a boycott is considered illegal, and there's certainly plenty of reasons to boycott these elections.
Name some of them.
Well, I think in the past these elections have been rigged in other years, but this year is worse than any. And what has really been the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of a lot of people's outlook on these elections is that Megawati, as I said, who is the most popular leader in the country right now, is not allowed to participate in these elections. She's had to be very careful about what she says because she doesn't want to cause more violence than there's already been, but she has come out in a statement and told people that voting is their right, it's not an obligation, and that she will not exercise her right to vote, which is the only way that she can basically say boycott these elections.
Medea Benjamin, give us a little background on Sukarno Putri Megawati.
Well, she is the daughter of the country's founding father, Sukarno. She has been leading the party called the PDI. She's quite a newcomer, actually, to the political system. It was only in 1993 that she started to head her party. She's not very well known in terms of her ultimate beliefs. She's been very careful not to criticize the entire system. She's a reformist. She calls for changes within the system. But even walking that very fine line has been too much for General Suharto. This is the first time that he's really confronted somebody who has popular support because of her father's name. And he doesn't like having any real contestants to his power. So he engineered a maneuver to get rid of her last year. And since then, people who were already frustrated with the system because of the tremendous inequalities between the rich and the poor, because of the tremendous corruption that exists at all levels in this country, when Megawati was ousted, that was really the breaking point for them.
Can you talk about the political violence that has taken place outside the ordinary political violence that's there in Indonesia?
Well, since there are really no ways to participate in a political discourse in any kind of normal way because they've all been banned by the government, one of the only ways to vent your frustration is to get out on the streets. And so the violence is really a condemnation of this, the tightly controlled system. People get out on the streets, and violence can erupt between the different political parties or between the political party and the government troops. There's many ways that violence has erupted during this campaign, but I think the root of it is all very much the same, that if people don't have a way to have a dialogue on the political process, if they don't have a legal way to oppose the system, then this kind of street violence is inevitable.
Medea, what are you doing with this global exchange delegation that you're on in Indonesia?
Well, we came here to look at what's happening during this election period. We have had to be very careful because we did not come as official monitors because we were told if we were official monitors, we would have a government person around with us the entire time. Now, we're assuming we have government people around us all the time, but we don't know who they are. And we have been speaking with opposition leaders. We've actually been getting inside the jails to talk to people who have been arrested because of their political beliefs. We've been talking to all members of the different parties as well as the unrecognized parties, and we've been going out into the countryside and talking to farmers. We've been going into the slum areas and talking to poor people. And what we found is a general frustration with the system. Now, many of the people we've been meeting were supporters of Megawati, and they have been in this dilemma about what to do. And I think this is what makes this election particularly interesting, is that many of the Megawati supporters have decided to boycott the election, and another portion of the Megawati supporters have decided to vote for the other political party called the PPP, which will undoubtedly get more votes this year than it has in the past. The question now becomes whether the government will actually give them the votes. It seems unlikely that they will get the votes they deserve, and that the question of how the PPP and its supporters at the grassroots will react to this kind of government cheating is the big question mark right here.
Who is on the delegation that you're a part of?
The delegation is made up of 24 members coming from seven different countries. The majority of us are from the United States, but we have representatives from throughout Asia and several from Europe as well. And they are lawyers and human rights activists, a couple of business people, people from the labor community, as well as a few professors and students. So it's quite a mixed delegation, but a delegation that has done its homework, has a lot of background in the issues. And I think we will have our press conference tomorrow right after the elections, and it will be very interesting to see how the government will react to our findings.
Medea, you mentioned that there are a number of labor representatives on your delegation. Months ago, you brought Cici Sukaisi to the United States, a young woman who worked in a Nike plant, and Global Exchange was largely responsible for bringing tremendous attention and pressure on Nike for their practices in Indonesia. Can you talk about the connection between these companies and the elections, if you want to call them that?
Well, the U.S. companies are here for an obvious reason, and that's not only cheap labor, but a repressive system. Their profits come from the fact that workers are not allowed to organize in any independent fashion. And the more time I spend here, the angrier I get at the conduct of U.S. companies. They take advantage of the fact that labor leaders are behind bars. They take advantage of the fact that the military is there to support the repression of workers. And they haven't lifted a finger to say anything about jailed labor leaders, to condemn these present elections, in quotes, to call for greater democracy in Indonesia, And I think we should just renew our efforts to push the U.S. companies who are in Indonesia either to make some efforts to democratize the system or get out.
The Presidential Task Force on Sweatshops, though it's not officially called that, you know, came out with their statement that they're going to work toward having a no-sweat label and at least toward developing international labor standards. How does that affect what's going on in Indonesia right now? And do you hold out much hope for these negotiations?
Well, no, it doesn't affect things at all. In fact, people laugh about that task force and say that it doesn't really matter here because you have a military system that's designed to keep workers repressed, that's designed to keep wages low, and that's the only reason the companies are here. And so if the things on the task force were really taken to heart, like the freedom of association or paying some kind of wage that had any relationship to people's basic needs, the companies wouldn't even be here. So I think it's all pretty farcical when you get down at this level to think that the U.S. companies are in any way, shape, or form interested in ending sweatshops. And in fact, it's just the very fact of sweatshops that brings them here.
The thousands of Nike workers that went out on strike because their plant tried to get a waiver from even the minimum wage that is paid in Indonesia. Did you meet with any of those workers while you've been there on this trip?
Yes, we met with Nike workers as well as many workers from many different factories who have been out on strikes recently. And you get a sense that the workers are definitely getting better educated than they've been in the past. They're not accepting the kind of maneuvers that the factory owners have done in the past to keep them from getting even their basic rights. And that this country is going to experience a lot of strikes in the future because the workers are being squeezed. Even the minimum wage, when they do get it, is not enough for them to live on. Sometimes they get the minimum wage and then they get deductions for all kinds of things, transportation to the factory, deductions for the meals that they're forced to buy in the factory, deductions for other kinds of, quote, benefits. And workers are really not going to take it anymore. So despite the government's tremendous efforts to keep workers repressed, to stop them from organizing, there are more strikes than ever before, and there certainly will be in the years to come.
Medea Benjamin, I know you got involved with Indonesia. One of the ways, the routes, was through your interest in East Timor, the occupied country occupied by Indonesia. I was just talking to José Ramos Horta, the Nobel Peace Prize winner this year, is from East Timor. And he said that in the last elections, Suharto won in East Timor by 105%, he joked, saying that that, in fact, was the case. But it shows, you know, what a fraud the elections were. 105% voted for him, despite the fact that that it seems that the whole country is opposed to him. That's the country of East Timor. Do you see a connection right now, as you're in Indonesia, between what's going on there now, these elections that they're calling them, and East Timor?
Well, the issue of East Timor comes up all the time, no matter what part of the country we're in, because in some ways it defines who is totally outside of the system or is anybody that advocates for self-determination in East Timor. And in fact, the labor leaders, Mukhtar Pakpahan, who is in jail, one of the things he's accused of is calling for self-determination in East Timor. The students who started their own political party who are in jail, one of the things that has come up time and again in their trial is that they advocated self-determination in East Timor. We were talking to students at the universities yesterday and found that there is a tremendous division between those who feel that the government did the right thing in East Timor because they have little access to real information, and those who seek information from outside in the most subversive places like CNN and try to get real news, and those who have news from the outside are the ones that agree that East Timor should have the right to a referendum on self-determination. So the issue comes up time and time again. In terms of these elections, it has been noted by a lot of the analysts that we've been talking to that the most repressive places right now include East Timor, that the most military out on the streets for the elections are in places like East Timor, that the most fear exists there, that nobody will talk openly about the elections in a place like East Timor, and there's tremendous pressure to vote for the government party of Golkar.
Is there a sense, although Suharto is not running in what's going on today, is there a sense that he will remain at the helm there as he has for 31 years?
Nobody thinks that Suharto will fulfill his next five-year period. There will be the president will be appointed next year. Everybody thinks that will be Suharto again, but that he won't fill his five-year term, that he will have to step down during that period. You certainly get the feeling when you're here that this is the beginning of the end of his rule. There is a tremendous division in the country between how people think that transition will take place. Most people are very anxious that it takes place in a peaceful way. They still have memories of what happened in the 1960s, of mass slaughter. They don't want that to happen again. And so the scenario that most people talk about is that Suharto will name a vice president who will be a weaker vice president than he could possibly be, and that during the next period, he will step down, the vice president will become president, and then the changes will start to take place.
Adia Benjamin, director of Global Exchange, a human rights group based in San Francisco. She's been speaking to us from Indonesia.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my life come shining from the west down to the east any day now, any day now. Every man needs protection. They say every man must fall. So I swear I see my reflection.
Copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to send us some email, you can send it to us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with Lauren Comito. Errol Maitland is our assistant producer and our engineer. Andy York, our engineer in Washington. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we will be airing the words of Vandana Shiva. We'll be talking about biopiracy.